Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the Major League Baseball season ahead with our guest, Chelsea Janes. She's a baseball reporter for the Washington Post. It's great to have her back. She's a wonderful writer. And as we talk with Chelsea, I hope you'll join in. What do you think about the new rules regarding Major League Baseball? Maybe you caught the Brewers' home opener yesterday. Where do you think the Brewers are going to land this season? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Chelsea Janes, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about, well, maybe the opening day, the opening week. What are your big takeaways?
You know, I think like everyone, I was very curious to see how the new rules played out. And like everyone who wants to get home from work a little quicker, I was happy to see that the pitch clock shortened game time. But more than that, I think it's been kind of a positive for the pace of the game itself, too. So my main takeaway is just that so far, so good on that front.
You know, I watched the Brewers' home opener, their first game with the Cubs, and then their third game with the Cubs. I missed the home opener yesterday. But to me, that pitch clock, which, by the way, it's 15 seconds with no runners on base and 20 seconds if there is a runner on base, right?
Yeah.
To me, you know, I was really curious about it, and I was kept watching it on TV, that those seconds winding down, a pitcher only having 15 seconds, and a batter, by the way, having to be in the box with 8 seconds to go in the pitch clock. But after a little bit, I kind of forgot about it, and I was just kind of pleased with how the game went.
You know, I think that's kind of the consensus. I mean, Major League Baseball years ago sort of realized, look, we know our really big baseball fans are going to want as much baseball as possible, but we aren't worried about the fans we already have. We want new fans. We want kids with short attention spans to like our sport. And, you know, I think from the very start of them trying to figure out how to do that, they identified a pitch clock as something that could basically vacuum out all the weird downtime and you know, guys fidgeting and walking around the plate, and just really kind of hone the game to action, to things actually happening. And it seems like that's what it's done. And, you know, I think it's one of those rare things in baseball that thus far has sort of had its intended consequence without a ton of byproducts that everyone's mad about. And I guess we'll kind of see if anything pops up. But I think the expectation and the hope is that you're not the only one who stops thinking about it, that maybe a few months from now, you know, we're not even talking about it anymore.
I was kind of amused from the batter's side. There are still guys who want to adjust their gloves. I noticed a few of them were a lot faster about it this time around, this year.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, it's a big part of the game. You know, guys have complained about that, about not having their walk-up music play long enough, right? Like, they don't get to enjoy the moment as much. But they'll adjust. But, it's not – in a sport where everything is so mental, it is not insignificant to force guys to change routines they've had for years.
You know, and I'm wondering if it hasn't helped – I think it's helped the Brewers. They've got a bunch of young players, new players. But, I mean, just in general, the newbies – for them, they don't have time to sit up there and think about things.
I think that's right. You know, I'll be interested to see sort of what people think after a year or two or whatever, because I do think that there is something to be said for not giving people time to think in the sport. I mean, everyone thinks the more you think, the better answer you will come to. And maybe in some cases that is true, but you know, at some point you kind of just got to get in there, and often the brain gets more in the way than you want. So, and the other advantage the Brewers have, like you said, they're relying on a lot of young guys, a lot of pitchers that worked quickly anyway. Young guys are used to those rules from the minors, and their pitchers really weren't slow workers to begin with. So that's not a roster that is going to have to adjust quite as much as everyone else, which I think, at least in the early months, is probably a real advantage.
Yeah, those young guys and the new players. I mean, Contreras isn't the youngest guy, but a new catcher. We got Bryce Terang, who walloped one yesterday. I believe he got a home run yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And Garrett Mitchell. I mean, those guys, really seem to put a lot of energy into the team.
Yeah, I think they will. You know, I think one of the things the Brewers have done, you know, they've been so good at pitching over the last few years, and they've just really struggled to hit. And often when you don't hit, people watch and say, oh, you know, they're not that energetic. They don't have that much going on. And it's just hard to look energetic when you can't hit, honestly, because not much happens. But I think, you know, the young guys that they have coming up are really promising. They're real potential major league hitters who can really help, and they have not sort of been beaten down yet by the idea that they can't perform. And you know, I think those are exactly the kind of players that when you inject them into a roster that's had a lot of success but maybe not won in the postseason or not gotten as far as they've wanted in recent years, you know, those young guys with energy who don't know better can often make a huge difference. So you know, I would expect them to, you know, have some ups and downs, but I think if you're a Brewers fan, you're looking at that and thinking, okay, maybe this is sort of the change that we need to do a little bit better this year than we have in the past.
That was kind of cool yesterday, the game. I didn't see yesterday's game, but I saw a little and heard a little replay from Brian Anderson, who calls the games for the Brewers. Calling a home run for Brian Anderson. I don't know how many times that's happened in Major League history, but a Brian Anderson calling a home run for Brian Anderson, they had to be almost a first. It certainly was a first for the Brewers.
Yeah, no, I remember when they hired, you know, when they got Brian Anderson over there, and they, you know, that was something everyone was kind of joking about, but it is funny. I mean, that's one of the great, that's what I like about baseball anyway, is there's all these little things that occur that are unprecedented every day. And that I would think is one of them.
You know, have you been to American Family Field or the Brewers Field?
I haven't this year, but I certainly have in, you know, almost every other year.
Yeah. Well, I saw an article in, I think it was Sports Illustrated, where they rated the stadiums, and Milwaukee's was rated way down, you know, like 23rd or something. And they said, oh, just another covered baseball diamond or baseball field. And I thought, oh, come on.
Yeah, I honestly don't agree with that assessment. I think it's, you know, there's so many stadiums you go to, you don't know, they could be anywhere. I think I live in D.C. and Nationals Park could be anywhere. But when I'm in Milwaukee, you know, I know I'm in Milwaukee. There's cheese curds everywhere. There's the slide. There's, you know, there's breweries, like, you know, so I think that's important. And it still feels very new there too. So I don't agree with that.
No, I don't either. And they did spend a whack of money this year on a new speaker system, for example. I think
I heard that.
They got like 50 or something, 150, I don't remember how many, but they put in some very expensive speakers so into a new speaker system so you can understand every word that the person is saying. Oh, man. So, well, which, if you had to pick a field, and you've probably been to most of them or maybe all of them, which one do you like the best?
You know, I it's tough. I really like Pittsburgh. I think for, you know, a city that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be a baseball destination, they made that stadium just an incredibly pleasant place to watch a game. I really like Camden Yards in Baltimore. I think it's just feels different than everywhere else. But there's a lot of the new sort of modern stadiums, you know, Miami, places like that. They have their benefits, like just in terms of logistics, but I think there's some character lacking there, you know, and I think places like Pittsburgh and Baltimore kind of give you that.
There's some changes, just one more, and then we'll get away from the fields. I know there are some changes to the field and a new contract for the field for the Brewers coming up. Somebody wondered, how do other teams fund updates to their fields?
Yeah, it's a good question. It obviously really depends. You know, I think Baltimore's in sort of a similar situation where they are working on a new lease with the city and had some bills passed that approved funds if they will stay, which is sort of my loose understanding of what you're seeing in Milwaukee too, like stay here, here's some money for down the road. And so they're kind of in a similar situation. But I think there are places that can afford to, you know, there are some owners who I think put a lot of money into the ballparks themselves. You know, I know the Washington Nationals, who I'm very familiar with, they're about 20 or so years into their stadium. And I don't know where that money's coming from. I don't know if the city is going to give it to them. And I don't think the ownership's going to put it there. So I think anytime you can kind of get local government on board, it's a good sign. And in places like Milwaukee, Baltimore, the smaller markets, it feels kind of mandatory because it's not coming from ownership. There's not excess money there to spend. So it really varies, but by and large, it requires some local buy-in, in my experience.
Yeah, and this is the 22nd year of the stadium in Milwaukee. So, 22 years doesn't sound like a lot, but in stadium terms, you know, you're looking at 30 years or so, and there needs to be some major upgrades.
Yes.
To the stadium in that amount of time, I would think. Well, you know, we talked about the pitch count, which I think yesterday the Mets pitcher or pitchers had some problems with the pitch count and not getting in there on time. But for the most part, the games that I watched, I think the first pitch count violation was in the Cubs Brewers game, the first day of the season. But what do you have there been a lot of problems around the league?
There really haven't. You know, what's interesting is it's kind of one of those things where the biggest problems have come from sort of rare situations. You know, there's only so much I think Major League Baseball could anticipate. And for example, like the Mets the other day had a horrible time, like you said. And one of the ways that they got in trouble was one of their batters had just walked, and he was kind of taking his time getting to first base, and no one was really paying attention. And the umpire noticed that his teammate was not in the batter's box and called him for a violation. But the teammate was looking at the guy running to first, who wasn't at first yet, and sort of, you know, the rhythm of the game did not dictate that he should be in the box. And something like that, I think, you know, they're going to learn how to have the umpires have better discretion or, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's just stuff like that, you know, even down to one of the things Buck Showalter, the Mets manager, talked about was if his left fielder is out there and leading off the next inning, is he going to have time to get back, to run back, to be in the box in time when you start the pitch timer? Like, you know, does he have to make sure it's someone really fast so they can run back on the field, get their batting gloves on and get ready? You know, there's all these sort of little things that have caused problems. And I think Major League Baseball is trying to sort of say, okay, let's have some common sense here. But by and large, you know, there haven't been that many violations. I don't know off the top of my head what the number is, but it's way less than it was the first week in spring training when it was new. So I think it's going to, you know, be a pretty limited occurrence.
Chelsea Janes, our guest today, baseball reporter for the Washington Post. Great to have her with us. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking baseball today with our guest, Chelsea Janes. I really like her writing. She's a baseball reporter for the Washington Post. I subscribe to the Post, and I look to her stories kind of the first thing when I'm looking for the papers. And we have a link to her stories on our the Larry Mueller Show page today. So go to today's date, and you'll see the link to her stories. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Gene emailed to remind me that Bryce Terang Not only he had a home run yesterday, but he hit a grand slam home run for the Brewers. So point well taken, Gene. Thanks for that. How about Jenny in Milwaukee? Jenny, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I was just about the timing of the game. I was at the ball game yesterday with my dad, and the fans have to get a little bit used to the speed as well. When we were cheering, there would be times where we'd still be cheering for the play ahead, and the next batter would be up. So it's like this refocusing thing. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes us to catch on.
Oh, interesting, Jenny. A comment on that, Chelsea?
Yeah, I believe it. You know, I've heard writers who are stressed out more because there's less time, and broadcasters saying they can't talk as much, which we know for them is true tragedy. So, yeah, it definitely requires a little bit of adjustment on everyone's part, I think.
Thanks. Well, one of your stories had rushing for hot dogs.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Everybody's in a hurry now. Yeah.
Everybody's in a hurry, wants to get back. Well, and the... What was the average game? About 2 hours and 45 minutes, somewhere around there, as opposed to 3 hours and 15 minutes or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's down about 20 minutes right now, and it might get a little bit lower, too, as we get into everyone kind of gets settled. So, yeah, it's not super fast, but it's definitely faster.
With the exception of, I think, St. Louis's opening game, which was...
Yeah, went on forever, yeah.
But still exciting. I mean, there were so many runs in that game.
Yeah. And a game like that would have taken 4.5 hours as opposed to 3.5. You know, even the long games are you know, the action-packed ones, they're just more action over more. So I think it works so far.
Yeah. Michael in Appleton, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not typically a big baseball watcher, but I wanted to call. I saw a clip floating around in the last week or so of, I don't know what team it was, but there was a catcher who was held out his glove to take the ball back from the ump right behind him, and felt that it wasn't coming and moved his glove right as the ump dropped it, and it missed the catch, and the umpire was not happy and felt apparently disrespected and kicked the catcher out of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the catchers claimed afterwards that he thought the ump was actually throwing the ball, which is why he took his glove away. But was that right, Chelsea?
Yeah, it was pretty funny. I think there was like a slight misunderstanding, because on the play before, the ump had thrown the ball back. So when the catcher didn't feel the ball in his glove, he thought that he had thrown the ball back, so he put his glove down. And, you know, something people don't talk about a lot is there are, I think it's like 10 new umpires this year, 10 rookie major league umpires. So I think there's a lot of people trying to kind of stake out their territory and prove they're not to be messed with. And I think that was a slightly extreme example. Yeah.
Well, Anthony Rendon has been talking about getting kicked out of the game. Anthony Rendon, right, got a game suspension. Mm-hmm. I think it was five to begin with, but they whittled it down to one game suspension. Are you familiar? Yeah, you. I know you are familiar with that.
Yeah. I think he went from 5 to 4. They didn't totally let him off the hook, but he grabbed a fan in the stands in Oakland, which was weird. Most stadiums don't really get the players that close to the fans anyway. And Oakland's just sort of so antiquated that they have to walk by the fans. And he grabbed a fan who had apparently been heckling him and told him he didn't like that and took a swipe at him. And fortunately he missed, because I think it would have been a huge deal if he had, you know, punched a fan. I can't imagine.
Oh, that would have been a lot of money and a lot of time without.
Yeah.
They didn't announce how much. He still got fined, too, along with the suspension.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, and he had to apologize, which, you know, some of them don't love doing. So he's been punished, but it was it's rare to see that in baseball, for sure.
Yeah. One thing we haven't talked about that I did want to talk about is the size of the bases now. It's bigger, and I think the number of attempted steals is way up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they made the bases, instead of 15 inches square, not square inches. I did that wrong before. They made it 18 inches square. So basically, you know, the bases are sort of 3 inches closer to one another because they're bigger. And the other rule, you know, that in itself, I don't think has inspired people to try to steal more. The rule that has is that pitchers are now only allowed to throw over to first base twice per at bat. You can throw a third time, but you have to pick off the runner. You have to get the runner out. So, you know, a lot of times if they've thrown over there twice, they're not going to take the risk that they're not going to get the out, so they throw home. But that means the runner at first knows they don't have to worry about the pitcher trying to get them, and they can get an earlier, you know, start towards second base. So I think people are being really aggressive, trying to take advantage of that now before everyone adjusts and figures out ways to stop it. But, yeah, thus far that's had a pretty big impact, and that's what the league wanted. They wanted to see more stolen bases, and so far they've definitely gotten them.
I was wondering if it wasn't, too, a combination of the larger base and maybe the pitch clock.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. I think the pitch clock has really taken some pitcher focus away from holding runners. People aren't as comfortable holding the ball. And you still have time to do it. I mean, Max Scherzer, who's sort of always trying to work his way around every rule that's ever been written, you know, has found ways to sort of, you know, time the pitch clock and stand for this many seconds and then stand for this many seconds the next time. And that keeps runners off base. But I think most pitchers right now are just trying not to get called for a violation. So there's not a whole lot of mental bandwidth to dedicate to trying to trick the runner at first. I think, you know, pitchers are just trying to kind of make sure they're on time.
Yeah, and I think Scherzer's pitching today for the Mets, so likely the Brewers aren't going to be scoring 10 runs today.
Yeah, I mean, you would think. I don't know. Who knows? But it'll be interesting. He's definitely the one to watch if you want to see somebody try to manipulate the new rules to their advantage.
And one other rule change that we haven't talked about is the infield, the new infield rule. Describe that and tell us how their teams may be trying to get around it.
Yeah, the infield shift rule is really interesting. I think a lot of these rule changes have been constructed to undo the effect of data in baseball. And one of the ways data really changed the game over the last couple of decades is it told everyone exactly where the ball was going to be hit more often by which hitter. So you could move your infielders to stop that. And what the shift has done is said, okay, you can sort of put your shortstop and second baseman where you want, but you have to have two infielders starting on one side of second, two on the other, and their feet have to start on the dirt. And when the pitch is delivered, they have to start there. So, you know, it's a complicated rule to enforce because you can be pretty close to second base and still be on the right side of it, or you can take off running when the pitch is delivered and try to get to that spot that you would have been in otherwise. You know, it's something that teams can challenge by replay, but they can only challenge it if the player in question is the one who touched the ball. There's sort of all these little nuances there, but the goal of that is basically, yeah, just to sort of give the field the traditional setup that everyone grew up watching and say, you know, if you can hit a ball between first and second, that's a hit. We're not gonna put somebody there to stop that. And so far, I think it's a very small sample, but there's been a little bit of more offense this year, and it has not been from home runs, it's been from singles. So it sort of seems like that goal that Major League Baseball wanted to achieve is exactly what's happening.
And especially for left-handed hitters, I think the thought was lefties would benefit the most from this.
Yes, exactly. A lot of the big left-handed hitters hit a lot of ground balls between first and second. And, you know, when you're a right-handed hitter and you hit ground balls between short and third, there's a third baseman and a shortstop who can both range over and get it. But when you're a first baseman, you can't really leave the bag, you know, as much. You kind of have to hover. So there's just a bigger hole there. And so lefties traditionally get more hits through that hole than righties do on the other side. And teams had started moving a shortstop out to the outfield and to that exact spot so that those wouldn't be hits. And now you can't do that. So, you know, I think the anticipation is that there are some big left-handed hitters who are going to have a lot more singles than they used to because, you know, that one place they hit the ball, you can't really put a fielder anymore.
Although I think in spring training, there was at least one team that tried moving its left fielder over.
Yeah, I saw that. You can get creative in the outfield. It's a high risk, high reward situation, you know, to not have a left fielder. It's going to be interesting. I think people will play with it, but I'm a little surprised at how how much people have adhered to it so far. There haven't been any crazy experiments during the regular season, so it'll be interesting if that changes.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how that goes for sure. Well, let's talk about some of the other teams as well. And, of course, the Mets were supposed to be, you know, maybe a team to beat this year, but they have had some injuries that they, I'm sure, didn't want to have.
Yeah, they've really been hit pretty hard. You know, they had their closer, Edwin Diaz, one of the best closers of this kind of era, you know, fell and blew out his knee celebrating in the World Baseball Classic. And then Justin Verlander, who they're paying $43 million this year, had a pulled muscle, so he won't be available for the series against the Brewers or you know, the first couple series of the year for them. And they've just kind of been hit, you know, in a few places that are really important. So, you know, one of the things that's hard, I think, when you spend as much as they do is there's just a lot of pressure. You know, you can't avoid the expectations, and it just feels a little bit scarier when things start to go wrong. And, you know, I think they're in that danger zone right now of seeing things go wrong and having a slightly slow start to the season. And, you know, that can get away from you really fast.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right about that. Well, and the other big name or at least one of the other big names I wanted to mention was Aaron Judge. Here comes the Judge. He's a captain this year, and I don't remember what his salary is.
It's
otherworldly.
yeah, I can't. Off the top of my head, I'm having trouble too, but it's a lot. Yeah.
Oh my goodness! But he made his presence felt right away in the first game of the year.
Yeah, first swing of the year, he hit a homer. He's a once in a lifetime kind of player because. It's not that easy to do that. You know, like there are some, you know, I was talking to someone about this yesterday at Nationals Park, actually, just how money and pressure and all that really, it really affects people. And Aaron Judge is in the city where he's getting a ton of money. I think they just committed like $360 million to him total. He's a captain. He's on a team that everyone expects to win. And it almost seems like he likes that, like he's better with that pressure, which just like is not true, you know, of most people. So it's, you know, good for the Yankees. They found someone that can kind of withstand everything that uniform forces on players. And yeah, he's a real, you know, physically he's obviously really rare, but it seems like mentally he's just immune to pressure in ways that I simply can't relate to.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And there have been so many times, well, there have been many times when players were given just enormous salaries to go somewhere else or maybe even to stay with the team they're in. And then it turns around and then suddenly, I don't know if it's the pressure or what, probably the pressure gets to them.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's hard not to because it's a game where, you know, two games into the season, you're 0-for-8. I mean, in New York, I mean, people write about that. You know, there's a game every day. Everyone has to talk about something every day. And, you know, it just spirals really fast. So I'm really, you know, I'm less surprised when people get bogged down in that pressure than I am when they can handle it. And I think that's why Aaron Judge is kind of so surprising. He just seems totally unaffected by it.
You know, this year to me, it seems like, well, at least here or only in my mind, but there's so much more excitement about the Major League Baseball this year. And I guess it's probably the combination of the changes. Do you think and I'm trying to think of the name of the World Baseball.
Oh, yeah, the World Baseball Classic, yeah.
I was going to say tournament, but it was a World Baseball Classic. What effect, I mean, I was interested, watched a bunch of games. How do you think that may have helped Major League Baseball?
You know, I think it helped a lot, and I think it helped more than anyone anticipated it would. You know, the World Baseball Classic has been one of those things that Major League Baseball has been trying to make a thing since, you know, I think 2006, 2009. And, you know, every few years it comes around and no one really cares and the stars don't really play. And, you know, it always seems more to me more to, you know, like the country of Japan than it does here. And it never really hit here. And I think for a bunch of reasons, one of which is, you know, Shohei Ohtani is playing for Japan, and Mike Trout and some of the American stars said, no, we're going to play this year. You just got a really true version of each country's best roster. Like, everyone seemed to want to be involved. And as a result, you know, everyone really cared. I mean, Dominican fans cared, Venezuelan fans cared. And, you know, I think Major League Baseball did something really smart, which is put a lot of the top Latin teams in Miami for their pool play games and then put the finals there too, which meant, you know, every game, the stadium was just crazy. It was like, you know, just louder than American fans normally are, just a different kind of energy. And it sort of just opened everyone's eyes to, like, this is how it can be. You know, it can be an exciting sport that people hang on every pitch and make a lot of noise and have chants, you know, like the Japanese fans do. It's just American baseball has always been so sort of don't show emotion, just kind of like take it day by day, be very even keeled. And, you know, over 162 games, that's a helpful approach, but it's not the only one. And I think, you know, there's just a lot to be excited about. And I think in some ways, you know, maybe American fans and Major League Baseball needed everyone else to let their kind of just have a reason to show a lot of emotion, have something to care about that's outside the norm, and remind everyone that, like, when this is a meaningful game that people care about, it's really exciting and that people do care about it.
Well, and I think Mike Trout deserves an awful lot of credit for, you know, leading the charge to get, you know, other, you know, the top baseball players to join the U.S. team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if Mike Trout's playing, it's kind of hard to say, you know, I'm not going to do that. The pitchers on the U.S. side still haven't really gotten into it. I think that's sort of the last frontier. That's, you know, every other team sort of had most of their pitchers, but the U.S. best starters did not participate. You know, even Rob Manfred, the commissioner, said that has to change. But I think it will. And yeah, once Mike Trout signed up and started sort of trying to get everyone else involved, I think it made a huge difference. And I think it sort of starts from Ohtani, who, you know, if Mike Trout looks over and sees Shohei Ohtani, his teammate, you know, getting all this kind of energy out of Japan, he's like, well, I got to do that too. And it's worked out that they were, you know, that combination really just lifted that event to a completely different level.
Well, and Trout said, hey, this is my one chance. He hasn't been for postseason play. And that brings to mind, you know, Ohtani's probably gone from California, from the Angels, after this year is over.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's been... I think everyone would sort of think that more too if he did a lot more interviews in English. I think from what I hear from people who speak Japanese, and you know, he's pretty frustrated when he does his interviews back in Japan or with Japanese reporters. He's pretty candid that, like, he wants to win, and that's not happening in Anaheim. And they could have a decent season, and I think that would still be true. But yeah, it's going to be absolutely wild, I think, starting about in June, July, to just see everybody start to line up and try to make their pitches for him. It's, you know, we've never seen anything like it. So I think he'll be treated that way.
John in Appleton will give you a chance. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning. And thank you both for all you do. I'm wondering of the guests and Larry, your opinion too on this topic. You know, we as a society value and put up sports heroes as role models. And they command exorbitantly huge salaries. So who will be the bravest person, sports-wise, whatever sport it is, to start donating their money and be openly, candid about, it's okay, I'm going to give a quarter of my millions of dollars to X cause. Mm-hmm. Or when will we... You get more humility versus selfishness in sports, especially the way money is used.
John, thanks for calling. What do you think, Chelsea?
I think it's a great question. One of the things that, you know, you're right that we sort of hold up these people as role models. It doesn't always mean they're equipped for that job. And I think sometimes we expect not too much of them, but we sort of ask something different of them than maybe we should when it comes to causes or, you know, their opinions. I think we'd all like our favorite athletes to stand up for the causes that we believe in or whatever. But a lot of them, to be frank, like, they've played baseball their whole lives. They're some of the most insulated people, you know, that I personally interact with. I think it's, you know, you wish that they would give to causes, but I think number one, I don't know that they're always equipped to evaluate them, you know, as well as you would like. You know, we ask politicians to do things like that, not baseball players. Now, that being said, obviously, I think some of them are incredibly thoughtful about those things and do take the time to think about them. And I think we're a lot closer than we've ever been to having people say, I'm just going to give, you know, X portion of my salary to this. You know, the Atlanta Braves have actually started working that into their contracts, like 1% of this guy's career or earnings on this contract are going to go to the foundation that the Braves have, whatever. So I think we're closer, but and I think just like social media makes those causes feel closer to these players. But by and large, I think we sometimes think they have a lot more bandwidth than they do to sort of contemplate their place in the world. A lot of these guys have really not done that or had much reason to. And that's why it's sort of so meaningful, I think, to people when you see somebody step out of the privilege that they're in and really consider what they can do with it.
Yeah. John, thanks a lot. Joan wonders how you got into baseball reporting.
It's a good question. I was lucky to do it. I grew up watching baseball and played softball all through college, and really I liked writing, and I didn't know much about anything other than baseball, so I just kind of pursued internships along the way and kept getting lucky and getting another one, and just kind of went from there. And when I got to the Washington Post, they, you know, eventually had a spot on the Nationals beat open up, and I was able to do that. It was a thrill. But I've just really only ever known about one thing, and unfortunately, they let me keep writing about it, and I hope that continues.
I do, too. And you had some pretty good schooling, too, if I remember. Weren't you a Princeton grad?
I was at Yale. I was lucky there, too. It wasn't great softball quality, but I was really lucky with the education side, for sure.
Well, Chelsea, I hope you'll agree to come back and be with us again. Will you do that? I loved talking with you.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for having me.
Chelsea James is a baseball reporter for the Washington Post. And as I said, boy, take a look at her column. She's a really good writer. And we have a link to her columns at the Washington Post at today's web show. So ideas at WPR.org/Larry. You can go there, and we have a link to her stories, quite a few of them up right now. We kind of talked about a bit of it while I was visiting with her today and while you were calling in with your questions. Well, coming up, we've got a guy, a doctor, physician, who thinks, and I almost agree with him, that he is the luckiest boy in the world. That's the title of his book. How'd you like to have been in the dugout with the Brewers and sat with the Bucks on the bench, or help the Packers out? He did all three when he was a boy and a young man. That coming up next. We'll be visiting with Patrick McBride. I'm Larry Mueller.